In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Rob and I are going to be talking about overcoming challenges with subscription pricing models. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 316. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us. The podcast helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, growing, and launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
We're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
Well, as I mentioned in last week's show, I went up to Lake Superior to have my retreat, to do a bunch of thinking and kind of relax. And the day I got up to leave Minneapolis to drive there, I was feeling terrible, like sore throat and all types of stuff, super tired. So I drive up there kind of like fever dreamish, like I was in and out of, I was certainly conscious, but it was in a state where you don't remember how you got there type thing. So I get there, I sleep 13 hours that night, and I get up in the morning and I look at my throat in the mirror with, you know, with a camera phone, and it's just brutal, just white spots all over the place. So it turns out I contracted strep throat right before my retreat.
Well, on the bright side, you didn't probably have to talk to anybody. So
that was the thing. It was exactly that. I was like, you know, this is a real bummer that I'm not, because I couldn't think well enough to like actually do retreat work. I pretty much watched TV and slept and listened to podcasts. But on the bright side, I didn't have to be at home around everybody, you know, because, you know, when you're sick and you have two kids that are waking up early and you're trying to sleep and you want to be with them and you want to be helpful, but like you're completely incapacitated. I didn't have that guilt because I was just in this cabin overlooking Lake Superior. Kind of couldn't think of a better place to be when you're that sick. So I was up there for 3 days and I was able to get some medication up there. Hour round trip to the nearest clinic, and I started feeling better by the last day. It was an eventful or an uneventful retreat, depending on how you look at it.
Kids running around when you're sick? I know not what you were talking about.
Oh, man. That's the worst. How about you? What's been going on?
Well, I got an email the other day from John Salmes, who is a attendee of MicroConf, and he runs simpleprogrammer.com. And he published a list of podcasts called The Ultimate List of Developer Podcasts. And we'll link that up in the show notes. But there are dozens and dozens of podcasts on here that are aimed really at the developer crowd. And it breaks them down into different programming languages and marketing and front end, back end, all sorts of different areas. So if you're interested, definitely check that out. And then the other thing is, my youngest son has decided that he's going to become a professional YouTuber. So that's a college savings win, I believe.
Boom. That's awesome. My 10-year-old has been talking about doing that for a long time. And I'm like, I don't really want to get everything set up to do that. But I think it's a good idea for kids to start thinking about that. I mean, that's the future, right? It's like I know it's the present for a lot of adults these days, but like for a kid to start tackling social media at this age, as long as you can, you know, keep them protected from stuff, I think is a good thing.
As long as they're, you know, 13 years old and they can click the button without violating the law.
Yeah. Exactly. So, hey, circling back to that podcast list from John Sonmez, there's an entrepreneurial section, a category, and I just want to read a couple of the podcasts. You'll probably recognize most of them. One is Entreprogrammers. Then there's Bootstrapped from Ian and Andre, although I'm not sure that that's still going. Bootstrap with Kids with Breck and Scott, although that's not going anymore. And then we have TechZing, Bootstrap Web, and of course, Startups for the Rest of Us, and a couple others, Rocket Ship and a few others. So you definitely want to check that list out if you have a chance. How about today? What's our topic for this week?
Well, what we're going to be doing today is discussing subscription pricing models and some of the challenges associated with coming up with a subscription model, and how do you logistically go about testing a subscription-based product. And I say subscription-based product as opposed to a SaaS application, because a lot of these things are applicable to any sort of subscription pricing model. So whether it's a membership site or a course that you're running, or obviously a SaaS application falls under that umbrella as well. But there's a lot of different products and types of products out there that essentially fall under this umbrella. Productized service, for example, might come under this if you're doing a recurring service for people over time on a monthly basis or weekly basis. All of those things kind of fall under this umbrella. So we're going to talk through some of the different challenges associated with, one, just deciding what type of pricing model is appropriate, but then moving on to how do you raise prices, lower prices, how do you start building up the service while you have all these incoming costs and you're not making as much money as you're putting into it, et cetera.
Cool. Let's dive in.
So the first one is how to go about testing whether you should be charging on a one-time basis or monthly or annual subscriptions. I heard the CEO of Atlassian named Scott. I can't pronounce his last name. It's Farquhar or something like that. But he talked at Business of Software and he was asked this exact question. And he said that if the value of a product goes up over time, then you should charge as a subscription. But if it maintains the same level or the value of the product to the customer goes down over time, then charge a one-time fee. And that's actually a very interesting way of looking at it, because if something's going up in value for the customer, then it's something that they're going to want to keep around for a much longer period of time versus something like a training course. You buy it once, or a book, for example. Once you've read it, you've kind of consumed that information and you're going to move on. And the impetus for you to continue paying on a subscription basis for that is no longer there. So I think that using that delineation of whether the value is going up over time or not as a determining factor in whether you charge monthly or, you know, on that subscription basis or a one-time fee is a very interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, so obviously there's a lot of pluses and minuses to this. I mean, I think if you run a software company where you are actually hosting and delivering value over time, then one-time fee is a terrible idea because you always need new customers in order to keep the servers on. But if it's downloadable software, then a one-time fee most likely makes sense because people don't want to download, host on their own server, and then pay you a recurring fee. I know there are some apps that do this, and frankly, they're bucking the trend a little bit. Now, if you have a SaaS app, then I think offering monthly and annual is the way to go. And the tests that I've seen people do are to basically just run a test on the pricing page and to see default to annual and see how many people go through, and then default to monthly and see how many people go through. And obviously, you're giving a slight discount, you know, maybe 1 or 2 months free or 15 or 20%, whatever you want to give for annual. And then you just do the math and you figure out, you know, not only do you make more money or not, but are you getting more cash up front or not? Because that's a big deal when you're bootstrapped. Now, if you're running a membership site, it is a little bit different because unless there's a lot of ongoing expense, then I have seen some membership sites basically do a one-time fee that's kind of a lifetime buy-in. And typically you want to have an asterisk there and say it's the lifetime of the membership site, not the lifetime of the user, right? Because the membership site may not be around for 40 more years, but the user may. So you have to walk a line there. And as long as people get a bunch of value out of the membership site, typically membership site lifetimes are, let's say, between 4 and 6 months. These are the average numbers I've heard based on this large swath of folks that I've talked to in our own experience running a membership site. And so if you give them a ton of value during that time and they get their money's worth, then it doesn't matter. I mean, the ongoing access is cool for them to have access to forums and such. But if 3 years down the road, you do decide, well, you know, they bought lifetime access and I'm deciding to shut this down, you're going to have very little pushback. Like, people understand that this stuff has to change. So I think that, you know, the question here is really, how do you logistically test this? And again, with SaaS, you just change it on the pricing page. With subscription site or membership site, I would just look at, you know, you're going to tend to want to do launches for membership sites rather than just have an open sign up process. And you're going to know your numbers. You know, you do 1 or 2 launches, you'll see the numbers of one, and then do 1 or 2 launches the other way and see the numbers. And I would just, again, compare, figure out how much cash you're getting from which one, and it'll be obvious. And then you will have, in this respect, if you change, you will have different cohorts on different pricing models. And that's okay. I mean, it's a small technical challenge, but it's not as much of a headache. Like, everything doesn't have to be cut and dried with this stuff. It's not as much of a headache as that probably sounds.
Yeah, and I think that the interesting thing to keep in mind about what you just said there was that when you do a cohort launch like that, most of the stuff that is based around the pricing can be completely hidden. You don't even need to have that on the website. So as you said, you can have some people on one pricing plan and some people on another. And really, I mean, that's kind of how you test it. So a lot of the pricing information that you're sending to people or that they're getting is through their mailbox. So it's not going to be publicly available. It's not going to be out there till the end of time. Now, something else to kind of keep in mind here is that when you are determining whether or not you're going to do monthly or quarterly or annual subscriptions or just that one time fee, there's a difference between charging somebody a subscription and then allowing them to essentially finance the payments over time. So I've seen emails from, for example, Ramit Sethi, who runs I Will Teach You to Be Rich. They have there are several different programs that they've offered or training courses where they will offer like quarterly payments or monthly payments for 6 months. And you're essentially still paying the full amount for the course. It's just spread out over time. And it helps the person who is on the receiving end of it view it in in a different light. You know, somebody may look at that and say, well, I'm not willing to pay $1,500 for a training course. But if they look at that and say, well, it's five payments of $300 each, it's the same amount. But they look at that and say, well, it's only $300. And they kind of mentally put a different spin on it than if it was a $1,500 upfront cost.
Something else to think about here is, can customers change pricing models after they purchase? So, you know, if they come on monthly, so you can, you know, lower their risk, and obviously they have a, you know, 30-day money back guarantee or whatever, and they're paying you $30 or $50 a month, getting people in and having them get value and seeing that your site is legit, and then after maybe 1 or 2 months pitching them on annual is also not a bad way to go, just to see how receptive people are to it. This is an approach that I've taken with several different apps. And the thought of whether someone can change pricing models after they purchase has to kind of play into effect here. I know that you don't need to do all the selling up front, and that you can wait until someone has gotten a lot of value to, it's kind of an upsell almost, if you think about it. Paying you $50 a month, and then you come and say, all right, here's $500 for a whole year. If you do that $500 up front, you're going to get less conversion rate. If you do it after 1 or 2 months, if people gotten value, you know, you can get a lot higher conversion rate on that.
One of the next challenges with subscription pricing models is, how do you go about raising prices? And this is a challenge, I think, for most subscription-based applications or products, because you don't really want to put the people who have gotten you to where you are in a position where they have to look at your product and say, oh, well, I'm really not happy with this particular move that you've made, or the decision that you guys have made to raise your prices, and I'm not happy about how you're treating me, because I signed on with the assumption that I was going to get this price for an extended period of time, or potentially forever, maybe in their minds. And some of them may be extremely upset over the fact that you are now raising prices. So one of the ways that you can combat this is to communicate in advance to everyone who you're raising prices for. Now, the other thing that you can do is, you can also grandfather those existing customers in. You can either do that in perpetuity, or you can do it for a specified time period. I've seen some companies where they'll say, look, you know, we're going to raise prices, but we're not going to do it for the next 2 years. So you're going to maintain your price for the next 2 years, or maybe it's 6 months or 12 months, whatever you decide, whatever makes sense for your business based on the lifetime of your customers. And you can go about increasing the prices for everyone else, or everyone new who signs on, as long as you make sure that you communicate that to the people who are currently customers and tell them, look, there's a price increase coming. It does not affect you. And I think that that's the big piece of that, is that you want to make sure that they know that that is not going to affect them.
Yeah, I think that's a big deal. I mean, I'm a big fan of grandfathering perpetually if you can, but obviously, you know, you look at the way Netflix did it, where they grandfathered for a year or two, and then it went up $1 or $2. I don't remember, it was inconsequential, but, you know, and at the time there's a little bit of hubbub up front, and then when it actually happens, a few people threaten to cancel, and you're always going to get somebody who cancels. So don't let 1 out of 1,000 people, you know, scare you into not changing it. But it really is an interesting idea. I'm a big fan of grandfathering. So, you know, you're not trying to piss off your existing customer base. We've seen this happen. Remember when Intercom was going to raise prices, and they were going to like double or quadruple their prices? It was a substantial change. And they were going to grandfather for like a year, and there was a huge uproar. And actually a bunch of people came to Drip and were saying, if you can build, you know, this one feature, I'll move over here, because they were so upset about it. And Intercom actually backed off on that price increase. There was such a backlash. It wasn't 1 in 1,000. It was like 20% of their customer base, or 30%, were just on Twitter and just railing on it. So you do want to be careful here and be thoughtful about it. Big price increases, I think it's really tough. Even if you grandfather for a year or two, if you're going to do a substantial price increase, it's going to have some backlash. The other thing to think about that I've used pretty successfully a couple times, actually several times, is to basically announce the price increase up front, let all your customers know you're grandfathered, thanks for all your support, the product keeps getting better, and you know you're going to keep getting it for the price you have it. And if you know anyone who, you know, you think could use it, now's the time to get them in, because as long as they start their trial before X date, which should probably be in the next 2 weeks to have some type of urgency, as long as they start your trial before X date, then they'll get the old pricing. And then you tweet that, and then you blog post that, and then you just promote the heck out of that, and you'll get this big spike of trials there. Now, you will kind of suck the air out of the month or the following month, because you pull anyone who is even thinking about trying you, and they're all going to rush in. So you're going to have a really good month followed by kind of a mediocre month, because you've really just front loaded it. But it's a nice way to get a big bump of customers, and I've seen it work both with Drip and with Hittail.
an offshoot of this particular topic is, how do you go about raising prices when your business model for the product or service is going to fundamentally change? So if it was, for example, a SaaS product before, and you've come to the conclusion that, look, you know, you really just can't support people either at that price point, or they're just not being successful with the product and they really need a lot more handholding, you may need to 5X or 10X the price in order to make things work and make the product successful for the vast majority of your users. And sometimes this comes into effect because you went down the route of having a free version of the product and your servers just got way too overloaded and there's so much stuff going through there that it's difficult for your backend systems to keep up, and you're not getting the conversion rate from, you know, the free users into paid users to be able to support the infrastructure for the product. So in cases like that, you have a fundamental shift in what your business is even offering. And I think that those are extremely difficult situations. I've seen it done in a couple of different ways, and I can't think of one where they did it really well. And I think part of that is just because of the fact that people have signed on with this expectation that you are offering X and that's what they are there for. And then you say, well, you know what? We can't offer X anymore. We're going to offer Y instead. And quite frankly, you're just going to piss a lot of people off at that point. I mean, you can only do so much in terms of grandfathering or pushing them off onto a different product or a different service. You can find other substitutes for them or help migrate data to other services that are going to be better fit. I think the one exception to that, where I have seen people do it reasonably well, is with Basecamp, where they have come out with additional versions of Basecamp. And what they've done is they've left everybody sitting there on that version of the product, and then they rewrote it from the ground up. And they said, hey, if you want to move to Basecamp 3, for example, you can go from 2 to 3, but you can't go back. So once you've gone to version 3, you can't go back to version 2. But anyone new is going to get version 3. Anyone on the old versions can stay there as long as they want, and they'll continue to support it, but they're not going to develop anything new. So as a customer, you kind of have a choice to migrate everything to the latest version, and maybe that comes with a price increase. But that's probably one of the best ways I've seen to handle it. Rob, what have you kind of seen from this?
Yeah, I mean, one example that comes to mind that, you know, you raised offline is Indinero, where they had launched and it was like a $30 product and they got up to 30K MRR or something and they just could not grow it because it was too low a price. And then they basically tried to 10X, or they did 10X their pricing, and they went with a productized service, which, to be honest, would be a fine move. I mean, it's fine to get into a market and then adjust it. The mistake they made is they just stopped supporting their product and it was so buggy and they kind of left their customers out to dry. And you and I both used Indinero. We used to recommend it to people and the product went sideways really bad and they tried to rewrite it and they just didn't support it well. And they were completely non-communicative, and then you'd email and you'd get a support response 2 weeks later or something. So they didn't handle the actual logistics of it very well. But the idea of going up market, I think, is a good one. And I think doing everything you can to kind of help those existing $30 customers would be what you can. So you don't basically tarnish the reputation of the founders and of the product itself. And if there's a way that you can straddle both of those worlds and grandfather existing, that's cool. If there's not a way you can do that, you just have to give people enough time, because it's an accounting system. You have to give them 6 months or a year. And if I recall, they gave us like 60 days or something to move off, which is like, no, all my stuff's in here and I have taxes in 6 months. You kind of want to think this through from a customer's perspective and think about, like, how much pain do I want to cause everyone, and how much do I want to piss people off? Because are they going to give me a chance the next time? Because we all, you know, this world of startups it's not huge, and you do have a reputation that you're going to want to kind of uphold.
Yeah, I think with Indinero, I think the big problem was that they had so many free users that they just couldn't support them. And I don't know what the stats that they actually had were, but assuming that it was 1 out of 10 people were paying customers, their systems were, as you said, it was buggy and it was slow and there were lots of things going on and they couldn't keep up with it. And I think in retrospect, you look back at it and what they probably should have done was said, look, if you're a free user, you've got 60 days or 3 months or something like that to get off the system. And then we're going to shut down your account and we're only going to focus on the people who are actually paying for it. Because they did have that free version of it, and we were above that, so we were a paying customer. But, you know, as you said, like, they didn't give us very much time to switch. So I think that that's really the issue, is when you don't give your customers time to react, depending on how integral the product is to the business of your customers, that's where things can become the biggest problem. So let's talk about the opposite of this. How do you go about lowering prices for a subscription model? And I think that if you have a subscription-based product, if at all possible, this is something that you want to avoid. I think instead, Rob, I think you took this approach with Drip at one point. You were looking at the products and you were building up Drip, and people were saying, yeah, I like it, but it's not worth it to me at this price point. It's overpriced for what I feel like I'm getting compared to some of the other things out there. And instead of lowering the price, you actually looked at it and said, well, how can I offer more value for the product instead of lowering the price? And I think that that's a perfectly legitimate and probably the best way to go in this particular situation.
Yeah, the idea of aspirational pricing is what I call it, right? And it's to realize that if you're charging 10, 20, 30 bucks a month for a SaaS app, it is really, really hard to get past like the 10, 20K mark. You just need a lot of customers to do that. And you need a really big funnel. So if you can go up market, if you already are priced at 50, 75, 100 bucks a month, it just makes it a lot easier to cross those thresholds and to start growing at, you know, that 5 or 10K a month mark, which is when it becomes interesting, in my opinion. So the thought here is lowering pricing. The problem with it is I can't imagine lowering pricing and not doing it for all your existing customers, because otherwise you're screwing your customers, right? If they're paying 50 bucks a month and then new customers can get in for 30 bucks a month, I don't see a way that you can justify not lowering across the board everyone's prices. And the challenge with that is then you're decimating some MRR that you've spent time building up. And, you know, that's actually a move that LeadPages decided to do after they acquired us. Our lowest tier was 49 bucks, and Clay wanted to move towards a free plan. And so our first kind of toe dip into that water was to do a $1 plan with up to 100 contacts. And when we did that, we looked at everybody who was under 100 contacts, and they were going to be downgraded. And it was like, if I recall, it was about $22,000 in MRR that just disappeared overnight. And that was a big choice, you know, and it was one that Clay had to make because it impacted the bottom line. Later, we moved to the free plan, which was much less of a hit because we already had a bunch of people on the dollar plan. But I couldn't imagine starting a $1 plan and not downgrading everybody. You know, there's really little justification for doing that. So all that to say, I mean, the reason LeadPages could do that is because they're a big company. They can wait out the massive support burden and all the stuff that comes with the $1 or the free plan. But as a bootstrapper, you know, I'm with you, Mike, like I would at any cost, like try to avoid lowering your prices and instead think about how can I offer more value, ask your customers, figure out what you can do to justify the current prices that you're charging.
I've had services where I've been a paying customer for them and, you know, had an account, and I go to their website and for whatever reason I'm logged out or whatever, and I take a look over at the pricing page and their current pricing is actually lower than what I'm paying. And I contacted support at that point and said, hey, you know, kind of what's going on over here? And they're like, oh, we're testing prices. I'm like, well, that's great and all, but, you know, I'm a paying customer here and you're charging me three times as much as what you're advertising here. And what I was told at the time was, oh, well, if we roll this out to everybody, then you can get that price in. I'm like, well, can I get it now? Because that's what you're advertising. And they said, no. So you kind of have to be careful about how you choose to deal with your existing customers, because I think that you can make them angry if they see that there is that lower price available to anyone new and you've been supporting them as a customer for a long time. So I think that's definitely something to keep in mind. The other thing that you can do is offer a credit of some kind to your existing customers. So if somebody is paying $100 or $200 a month or something like that, and you drop the prices by $50 or $100 a month or something along those lines for the plan that they're on, you can give them a credit and either drop it by a percentage for the next 3 to 6 months, or you could just say, okay, we'll give you a credit for the next 2 months until you're back to the point where they're paying the same as what those other people are paying the new customers. So I think that those are two different ways of dealing with it. I think if you're offering a percent off as a discount over 6 months, it's less of a hit to your revenue than it would be if you offered them just an X number of 3 months for the next time period.
Yeah, I like that. That's actually a pretty good way to think about it. And I think most customers would probably be okay with that, especially if they're using your service already and you kind of let them know, you know, hey, I have to lower prices and this is what's going on. We're bootstrapped. I don't have the cash to just decimate this, but can I give you a credit? I think that's a nice kind of in between. And I think if there is some real pushback, you can decide if you want to let some folks truly, you know, downgrade versus actually giving them refunds or whatever is required. So I think that's a creative way to think about doing this if you do find your back to the wall.
The next challenge is more of a logistical one when you're building up the product. And how do you go about avoiding overpaying for supporting and building your subscription product? And this goes along the lines of other subscriptions that you have to purchase in order to just host or build your product or offer it as a service to people. And the money that you're making from it doesn't match or even meet what it is that you're paying for those other services. So let's say that you have a product where it's costing you $1,000 a month for hosting costs, and you're only making $500 a month for it. You're essentially financing your service for the customers. How do you go about dealing with that aspect of building out your service?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple ways. One, you know, there's ways to kind of do it on the cheap. Like I know we talked about Wistia and how it's $100 a month, but there's a service called Sprout Video that admittedly does not have all the features of Wistia, but it's like 15 or $20 a month. And so you start there and yes, you're going to have to migrate later. And yes, that's going to be a pain. But if that $80 difference is something to you, then you're just going to have to put in the time to migrate at a later date, you know, if you later want the features. So that's one way, is to kind of just do it on the cheap.
Wistia changed their pricing, so it's only like, they actually have a free plan, and then they have, or at least they used to have like a $25 plan.
That's interesting. Okay. So maybe Wistia is not a good example, but if you're spending $1,000 a month in hosting on a membership site, then you're doing something crazy. And my guess is you could do a cheaper, perhaps less reliable, more of a pain in the ass way, but you could find a cheaper alternative. An example is when I launched the Academy, I mean, I launched it on WordPress with a WordPress plugin forum on Dreamhost. So like literally the costs were $10 a month. And then I think I was even embedding the videos there. I don't know if Wistia was around in 2009 when I was working on this, but I did it really on the cheap. Now that created some issues later on, right? 3-4 years later, forum stuff was all out of date. WordPress was in shambles. I mean, there was just all this, you know, WordPress wasn't in shambles, but the plugins and all the stuff that we used was kind of a nightmare. But it did allow me to get out of the gate really inexpensively. Another way is to basically pre-sell it, right? And so you're not putting in all this money up front, but with a membership site especially, you're going to be selling based on a little bit on your personal brand, a little bit on the promise of the content you have. So go create some content and you can host that for free on YouTube or super cheap on Vimeo and put it on your blog and send it out in emails or as PDFs, just any way that it can be free. And, you know, build the list, show the list what you're going to do, and then say, look, I'm launching a membership site where I'm going to put out awesome stuff like this, but it's going to be even better, and paint a picture for them what it's going to be, and then pre-sell the thing. And, you know, essentially, you know, again, coming back to the Academy, when I launched it, I had 2 weeks worth of content done. I was only 2 weeks ahead of the people who were at the forefront. And so when I initially sent those emails, I sold, what was the number? I think it was 100 subscriptions at $50 a month, if I recall. It was a long time ago, so don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure that was what I pre-sold. So it was $5,000 a month. So right then I knew, well, this is what I can put into it. And obviously it grew from there, but that was the basis for me to then say, okay, well, I can pay a few hundred dollars a month for hosting, or I can afford to hire a designer to actually do this a little better. So I think that's another way to think about kind of de-risking this for you. Membership websites are a little bit easier to do that with, and info products are easier than with software.
Yeah, pre-selling is obviously one of the ways to go with this. But the other thing to keep in mind is that for the different services that you're paying for, or the hosting costs or all the stuff that goes with it, do you really need them, or can you go with a lesser version of them? And yes, it can be a painful experience to transform them later or change them over to a different system later on. But at the same time, you want to hedge your bets a little bit. So if you don't have enough information to really decide how much money you should be putting into it, or how many customers you're likely to get in a certain time frame, you kind of have to hedge your bets a little bit and figure out where you're going to put your money and how you're going to invest in the product moving forward, because you don't want to be spending a ton of money up front for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months before you get to the point where you are past the break-even point. And that's something else to keep in mind, is that break-even is different than revenue. There's typically a minimum number of customers that you need to make any product profitable, and you need to know roughly what that is. And along with knowing what that is, you need to understand what the time frame and growth trajectory of the product is. Because if you're only adding, let's say, 5 customers a month at $50 a month, then you're growing at $250 a month of MRR. But if you're running at a $3,000 loss every month, it's going to be a long time before you get to the point where that product is paying for itself, and you're probably not going to be able to support that. So those are the things that you really need to keep those numbers in mind when you're building this out and determining what services to pay for. The last thing I think here is that when you are trying to figure out what those services are and where you can spend a little bit less money, you can run it by some of your early alpha customers or people that you've talked to or, you know, prospects about what is important to them and use that as a basis to figure out where you should be spending the money. Because a lot of times you'll look at something and say, oh, I really want this, but at the end of the day, it might not actually matter all that much to your customers. As Rob said earlier, when we built the Academy, we built it on WordPress. And that's technically free, but I mean, there's obviously a lot of work that goes into building all the different modules and stuff that went into the Academy, but that's not something that you should probably be paying a heck of a lot of money for out of the gate. And I think we've made this mistake ourselves when we switched over to a different platform and we were paying $1,000 a month for it at one point. And quite frankly, it didn't work out. We thought that it would. And fortunately, this was much further down the road when the revenue was there. But if had we made that mistake early on from day one, I don't know as the Academy would have ever succeeded.
Free like a puppy, Mike. It was free like a puppy.
Yes.
It took some work to get us out of there.
So the last challenge to tackle is, what if the product itself doesn't work out? What do you do with your existing customers? Did you guarantee that they'll receive this at the same price and the same service level forever? And we talked a little bit already about being able to modify the price. What we didn't really talk about is, what happens if you go out of business or you just can't support the product anymore because, you know, it's losing too much money? And businesses stop operations all the time. And this sucks, but small business owners understand when other small business owners are having a hard time. If, you know, the finances behind a product are not working out, there's lots of companies and lots of apps out there that have simply shut down and ceased to operate. Now, when you're forced in that situation, you do want to go essentially the same route that we talked about earlier, where if you're going to raise prices or shift your business model dramatically, you have to let people know. You have to give them ways to get their data out. You have to give them other options that they can use. If you just flip the lights off one day, people are going to be pissed and they're going to remember that later on. So those are things you absolutely want to avoid. But communicating with people as frequently as possible and helping them to either transition to another product or service or to get them the data that they need, whether it's raw database exports into Excel files or something along those lines, you need to make sure that they have what they need in order to be able to take their business elsewhere and, you know, take their data with them.
Yeah, shutting a service down is tough. And I think it depends on, again, if it's a membership site versus software. This does happen. And it's something that we all deal with, and it's always disappointing. But I think you're right. I think the more notice you can give people and the more reason, you know, if you can really explain to people what happened here, that you're running out of cash or that it was just never a viable business, and the more time you can give them and you know, allowing them to export their data and giving them instructions on how to import it into another comparable service and even talking to that comparable service and letting them know, hey, I'm shutting down and I have 70 customers. Is there any way you can help these folks with a transition? I think you kind of owe it to your reputation. I think you owe it to the customers who believed in you to do everything you can to help them do that. If it's more information, I feel like allowing folks to basically download everything so that they can take it with them, so that it is, you know, it is something they purchased and they can use it moving forward. But if you need to shut down a service again, I think just talking to folks as a person and letting them know what's gone on with you, you know, is it a health issue you've gone through? Is there a life change, a divorce or a death or something that is just catastrophically kind of wrecking your ability to run the business, or was it just not viable and you couldn't do it? That's kind of how I would approach it. Well, that wraps us up for the day. Again, this episode was based on a question asked by Marcus Biel in Founder Cafe. If you're interested in joining close to 1,000 other startup founders, bootstrap startup founders around the world, go to foundercafe.com and apply to join. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Out of Control by Moot. It's used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.